Welcome to the Eureka Street Crypto Hub, where Eureka John brings his raw experience, news, and nonsense. None of this is financial advice. I wouldn't take it, even if it were.
And I've been going at it for over a year now, and I've started doing this every single day, February 6, 2021. I started doing this for my very first show, October 24th, 2020. I've been in crypto since about 2018, and as my interest and my journey down the rabbit hole went deeper and deeper, I decided I need to stop bugging my friends and family and coworkers about this. I need to just purge it all out of me in the morning before I go about my day, and that's what I do. And this is my discipline also to help continue to learn more about crypto every single day, because I believe that regardless of how many articles or videos I watch or books I read or podcasts I listen to, if I don't try to express these concepts outside of my head, then I haven't fully learned them if I can't articulate them fully, because that's an entirely different level of learning process altogether. Your intake and then your interpretation of that intake and how you are able to clearly articulate that. And yeah, when you try to articulate it, you know, they always say teaching is, you learn by teaching a lot of times. Sometimes teaching is the best way to learn. So that's basically what I'm trying to do here is I'm disciplining myself by inundating myself with a lot of times language I don't understand. But I believe in the background that my brain is picking up a lot of this stuff, because that's how I started learning about cryptocurrency and all this stuff. You know, I started just mowing the lawn, going on jogs, driving around, doing whatever I need to do, always with my earbuds in, listening to different podcasts, even if I had no idea or understanding or conception of it all. I didn't even know what KYC and AML was at the very beginning. That's know your customer and anti-money laundering laws. I didn't know, you know, what sharding was. I mean, that's still a difficult concept, you know, yeah, there was no layer two at the time. There was no roll-ups, you know, and I was sitting there listening to Sergey Nazarov of Chainlink talk about oracles, and that was a brand new concept at the time. The oracles are what transfer information from the real world to the blockchain, and that's the piece of middleware that does that. But yeah, I had no clue about all this. I didn't know anything about finance. I didn't know what an index fund was, didn't know what a T-bill was, didn't know anything about charts or technical analysis, cups and handles, Wyckoff effect, and all this other stuff. You know, I just, yeah, the blank slate, you know? I even had to start from the beginning. Just what is money? And you just pull out all your assumptions when you jump into crypto. And a lot of people, I get in it for the investment opportunity, you know, like, no. Yeah, sure, right? Yeah, you can make money, you know, it's what attracts a lot of people to the space. But you don't just stay there. Yeah, I still look at the CoinGecko charts every single day, right? You know, but it's kind of like me when I open a newspaper back in the 90s, you know, when I got newspapers, and I would go first to the sports stats and look at the Major League Baseball, Major League Football standings, the NFL and the MLB standings, and see where my team was, the Houston Astros. And I would look at all the stats, wins and losses, and then I would go to individual player stats and look at all that stuff and see how each member on the team is doing. It's kind of what I do here with CoinGecko. You know, every day I just kind of wake up in the morning, I open up CoinGecko, I see where the coins are. And I believe a lot of this happened during the COVID era. Sports was shut down for like a year, and I'm not a huge sports guy. I mean, I like baseball and stuff. I'll watch some football, but it doesn't consume my life. But it's just something to keep up with on a day-to-day basis. It's something to rally behind. It's something to talk about whenever you're small talking at work and stuff like that, so you don't have to just dive into just deep and possibly offensive or complicated subjects with somebody you don't really know, because that's part of relationships. You know, small talk is useful. It's a buffer to try to feel and measure out and litmus test on somebody on whether or not they'll react well to some things you may or may not have to say. And small talk is a good type of buffer mechanism for that. So sports went away during the COVID era. And what did people have to do? You know, we were locked in our houses and everything like that. Well, we turned to the stock market, and then we had the whole GameStop shorts and all that stuff, Wall Street bets. And you know, the curtain was pulled behind the stock market industry. And then we also had people jumping into crypto. And crypto is a really interesting monster altogether, in that people are very tribal and they pick their blockchains and their projects, and they you know, the XRP army, the Chainlink Marines, the Ocean Navy, you know, they everybody, the Bitcoin maxis, of course, you know, and you know, the ETH unicorns. I don't know. Yeah, it's just like everybody, you know, has and they form these logos and these communities and these philosophies behind that are represented by blockchain and crypto projects. You know, so there's a lot of scams out there too. You know, in 2017 they had the peak of the market back then, and it was just white paper, and a white paper is just, you know, a concept written down on paper, and it's called a white paper, and it's supposed to lay out what your project is, what your blockchain or crypto project is, and you would submit that for an initial coin offering to try to raise funding for your project. Well, what happened is a lot of these white papers were written, and just money was just flooding in because this amazing new crypto technology. And then, you know, the people that wrote the white paper were just later, you know, they were out. So crypto sunk in 2018. I entered the space in 2018, just after all that 2017 boom, when people were talking about Lambos and stuff, and they didn't even have decentralized finance back then. It was all just speculation and white papers and niche stuff, just basically surrounding, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then a bunch of other wannabe blockchains that were out there trying to compete. And everybody was trying to make a new Bitcoin. You know, and Ethereum built smart contracts on it and was becoming a virtual machine. So everybody's either trying to compete with Bitcoin or Ethereum, you know, creating smart contracts on their blockchains, going faster than Bitcoin, being more scalable than Bitcoin, you know, so because Bitcoin is slow and decentralized, but it's super secure, you know, but it also doesn't really have smart contracts on it. So you can't do DeFi on it. And so I don't know. But yeah, that's just a little brief summary of everything that's going on. I'm obviously not a financial advisor, and I'm not a teacher, so don't tune into my show thinking I'm going to be giving you some kind of lessons. This is just my daily brain dump. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, I just love talking about this stuff too. So let's move over here to CoinGeckos. Take a look. Things are down in the red right now, which is I believe it's really healthy. You know, this is actually, in my opinion, this is a good time to buy. Bitcoin's at 56,000, Ethereum's at 4130. It's been like this for about a week or so, maybe a little over a week. I don't really have a lot of spare money. You know, I'm paycheck to paycheck pretty much with my job, but I dollar cost average with what I can. And I earn money through DAOs by doing bounty projects, I've joined online Discord societies, you know, and I was having a little talk with my daughter last night because she wants, you know, to find a job and to earn money while she's in college. I'm like, well, I was like, I'm not going to try to push my crypto stuff on you. I was like, but just go into Discord or just join some kind of community of something that you like, and then jump in and then just pick up a broom wherever you're in, you know, and maybe some kind of DAO or something. And you'll earn through that, you know, and by making yourself useful by plugging in and being an asset to a community rather than extracting value, adding value to a community rather than extracting value. And then through that, and I go, and it takes longer, you know, it's not immediate results, but over time it builds up. And of course, it's not what, you know, the 21-year-old kid wants to hear. I never thought I would be that dad figure, you know, to be like, you know, you got to work hard. It doesn't all show up happening at once. Cause I remember when I was 21, you know, you wanted it all to happen at once and stuff like that. And I took out terrible loans from the student loan agencies that I'm still paying back to this day and stuff like that. But, you don't listen cause you know, but at the same time, I still worked my entire way through college. So, whether or not I was peddling blue jeans at a blue jeans store, or, you know, in New York, or Urban Outfitters in Houston, or, you know, working in the walk-in booth, we call the box, in our dormitories or whatever. I always worked and tried to make some extra money through college. So I digress. So let's go over here to Twitter. And Chris Dixon, the myth of ETH killers, why demand for blockchains will always outpace supply. Okay, so because people say that there's a lot of Ethereum killers out there. Some of the Ethereum killers in the top 10 here is Solana. Another one is Cardano. XRP is kind of a different monster, but it could, you know, back in the day, it was considered one. Polkadot, Avalanche, these are all considered layer ones and all considered Ethereum killers, right? And I don't believe the concept of Ethereum killer exists anymore. And you'll see why here in a second, okay? So these are all the competition of trying to compete. Back in like 2018, it was Nano, it was EOS, you know, it was a few others as well. But those kind of dropped out of the race. They dropped out of the standings. Okay, so the myth of ETH killers, why demand for blockchains will outpace, always outsupply. And notice I didn't say Bitcoin, because I don't believe Bitcoin and Ethereum are really the same thing at all. So so for every important computing resource in history, demand has outpaced supply. This includes CPUs, GPUs, memory, storage, both wired and wireless bandwidth. The core dynamic of computing movements is a mutually reinforcing feedback loop between applications and infrastructure. Okay. Consider a modern smartphone. The phone itself is much better than a decade ago, and so are the apps. The apps drove the popularity of the phones, which gave manufacturers more money to reinvest. Improved phones increased the app design space, and the cycle repeated, so it was a feedback loop. So in the 2000s, when broadband penetration reached the minimally viable levels, entrepreneurs created video sharing sites like YouTube, which spurred broadband even more, making video streaming work even better in a reinforcing loop this time. Still again, as GPUs got better, game developers invested in higher fidelity graphics and experiences, which grew the video game market, giving GPU makers more money to reinvest in chips, and so on. The pattern happens over and over, and is one of the main reasons computers have become ubiquitous and so important in our lives. Now let's talk about blockchains. Programmable blockchains are computers. You can write near Turing complete code for them, store information in them, and so on. It's likely that, similar to other important computing resources of the past, demand for blockchains will consistently outpace supply. This is already true for Ethereum itself, and will likely also be the case for layer twos, sidechains, and other layer ones. So yeah, I mean, we have all these other Ethereum killers popping up, like I just showed you here, with Cardano, with Solana, with Polkadot, with Avalanche, all in the up near the top 10. Avalanche is 11, but it's been fighting with Dogecoin. But anyway, back to the tweet. So today, Ethereum has roughly 10 million monthly users, which is roughly 0.2% of all internet users. Over the 2020s, usage will hopefully grow significantly, both in terms of number of users and in terms of number and frequency of transactions per user. Many of the apps that will drive this growth probably haven't even been launched yet. It's possible that they haven't even been imagined yet. The more blockchain infrastructure projects, the better. For one thing, it's important to fully explore the design space, including different approaches to scaling, security, governance, and developer and user experience. Some of the designs will fail, and others will make fundamental trade-offs. Actually, I think it's important that some fail, because that's a free market, and you want to have tons of options out there, and you need to see what doesn't work. For example, it's plausible to imagine a world where frequent use, low-value transactions happen on blockchains that trade security for performance. assets that increase in value can then be moved to other blockchains that prioritize security over performance. So that's where I think a lot of these ETH killers, quote unquote, will come into play, and they will coexist with Ethereum. For instance, Avalanche and Solana, for instance, they focus a lot on speed and scalability, right? So imagine a world where frequent use, low value assets happen on blockchains like Solana and Avalanche that trade security for performance. Because Solana has been criticized of being extremely centralized. So assets that increase in value can then be moved to other blockchains that prioritize security over performance. Okay, all right. So something would start off on Solana or Avalanche as a low value asset and a low value transactions, but as it increases in value, and for instance, you start having large institutional type of investments and transfers go back and forth, then you would want to go to an extremely secure blockchain, decentralized, because you're paying for that blockchain space. What are you paying for whenever you pay for blockchain transactions? You pay for the blockchain space. You pay for that transaction being processed. You pay for that secure source of truth to put your transaction and your agreement on. And that's why people say, well, Bitcoin's going to be the winner in the end. And then in the very end, Bitcoin will be so far tucked away into the ultimate value of being transferred across that it will be like nation states, you know, sending trillions of dollars on peace treaties across and stuff off of Ethereum layer one and Bitcoin and stuff like that. And then we'll do all our daily transactions on something like a Solana, maybe a Cardano. I don't know if that ever happens. So anyway, so yeah, I could go on that point for a while and I won't belabor that point too much. But anyway, it goes on to say, it's also important to have many blockchain infrastructure projects because when exponential growth kicks in, we'll likely have a consistent shortage of high quality infrastructure. So these ETH killers, you know, a lot of Ethereum maxis sit there and dog on all these other ones for being too centralized, for, you know, whatever, you know, and then all the L2 people and other blockchains sit there and dog on Ethereum for being too slow and too expensive. Bitcoin's a dinosaur, all this, you know, but, and, you know, then we have new players like Terra and crypto.com coming in here. These layer twos like Polygon, you know, but this is important that we have all these different blockchains coming up. So, because it's like, as Chris Dixon says, it's also important to have many blockchain infrastructure projects because when exponential growth kicks in, and it hasn't even kicked in right now, we are at 0.2% of all internet users are using Ethereum. 0.2%, 0.2%. So you're early. You're still early. You may think if you're in the crypto space and stuff like this, that everybody, you know, knows about it. Oh my God. It's important to have as many of these blockchain infrastructure projects going and stable, because exponential growth is going to kick in. So we'll likely have a consistent shortage of high quality infrastructure. So regardless of what project you're in, put your all into it and do it well, because one day the masses are coming. And so right now, we're all setting up our tents at the bazaar, you know, and the gates haven't even opened yet. And we're all sitting there bickering whose little storefront is the best. Set up your storefront, get your inventory ready. The masses are going to be coming because the flea market opens at 7 a.m. The dawn hasn't even come yet. You know, the sun is just starting to crack. You know, so we're setting up our tents, and then once the gates unlock and the masses roll in, it won't matter about the blockchain. I mean, it will matter, you know. I mean, you might need to settle up at the end with a flea market central office or something. Which was, is that Bitcoin or Ethereum? I don't know. But anyway, so computing movements are positive sum games. There can be many winners at both the infrastructure and the application layer. It's important to run a variety of experiments and stay focused on the bigger goal of bringing blockchains and Web3 mainstream. And I think He brings an interesting point. There can be many winners at both the infrastructure and the application layer. So there's a bunch of layers in all this too. So quickly, I know that the Bankless guys, Ryan Sean Adams, David Hoffman, have been talking a lot about monolithic versus modular blockchains and the move and the evolution of things from just one monolithic platform blockchain that covers everything, execution, data availability, all in one large blockchain. But what is happening is all the tasks are being split up into small little containers and composable containers that you can, you know, put on top of each other and within each other like Lego blocks. Okay, so this is not unusual and it has happened before fairly recently as of 2019. So I will tell you how this is happening. Ethereum 2.0 is evolving from one large monolithic blockchain that covers all the aspects and different protocols and layers of blockchain transactions. And it's putting it and it's making it modular in Ethereum 2.0. So there's a lot of layer one blockchains that are just, they do it all. They do it all. They're one big thing, you know? But yeah, imagine if you had little cubicles that did it all, and then you had one central processing coordination booth that tells all the different components where to go. So let's move over here to this article by Polinia. Processors and blockchains, modular is revolutionary. So there's, okay, so this, okay, this is this, they say this one's a bit out there, but I promise it's relevant to blockchain tech. Stick with me. For the longest time, CPUs and GPUs were just one slab of silicone. And the industry die. So there is just one slab of silicone and a silicone die. In the industry, it's called monolithic die or a monolithic chip. Something like this. And it shows a picture of just one solid slab of silicone. Without going into the details of silicone fabrication. Basically, silicone always has small defects. The larger the die, the defect rates increase exponentially on top of being more expensive to produce in the first place. At some point, the die becomes too large and the defect rates too high that it becomes infeasible to produce. So these inefficiencies mean the cost of producing dies increase super linearly with size. And that's something a lot of people don't think about. You know, I have previously in my life, and through my dad and my family, have come from metal shops and machine shops and machinery and metal shops. You have forgings, and forgings require dies in order to stamp out the forgings, and moldings require dies, and creating these dies is a process in itself. And if you don't create a good die, you don't create a good project. So the larger the die is, a lot of times the more difficult it is to create. So this rings familiar and home with me. So basically, yeah, silicone has small defects. The larger the die, the defect rates increase exponentially on top of being more expensive to produce in the first place. At some point, the die becomes too large and defect rates too high, becomes infeasible to produce. So producing dies increase super linearly with size. In 2019, Intel's fastest CPU was Xeon Platinum. Platinum, a 28-core CPU costing a staggering $10,000. AMD released their competitor, a 64-core CPU costing $4,000, and completely obliterated Intel's very best. Double the performance for half the price. AMD just knocked the socks out of Intel back in 2019 and made Intel look like a dumbass and threatened to blockbuster Intel. So that's right, a 4x improvement overnight for an industry where you'd expect 2x in 18 months. And here's what and Tech had to say. I don't know who that is, but okay. So AMD has done the unthinkable, beaten Intel by such a large margin that there's no contest. For now, based on our preliminary testing, that is the case. The launch of AMD's second generation EPYC preset processors is nothing short of historic, beating the competition by a large margin in almost every metric: performance per watt and performance per dollar. So how did AMD pull off this miraculous feat? They modularized the monolithic die. So instead of just one slab of silicone right there with some large die. They had a bunch of little slabs around one central die that's a little smaller than the larger one. So, yeah, they broke it up into pieces. And, so I had no idea this revolution was happening in 2019. What was I doing in 2019? You know, I was traveling around the country, basically selling hose products, you know, so, I was a traveling salesman and working in commodities. So how did AMD pull off this miraculous feat? They modularized the monolithic die. Instead of one giant slab, you now have eight tiny modules called chiplets. One medium-sized die in the middle coordinating everything containing common elements shared across chiplets like memory controllers and input outputs. These small dies combined can be larger than a single monolithic die. So all the dies combined are larger than that one slab of silicone. So you have all these little pieces of silicone broken up into smaller manageable pieces, but together they're larger than that one chunk. So also given the super linear cost of larger dies, it'd be far cheaper to produce these as well. So you wouldn't have to make that one big ass die, because making dies is complex and expensive. But once you make the die, it's just like the printing press, the Gutenberg press. The Gutenberg press was difficult to make, but once they made it, they were able to reproduce the Bible multiple times and completely revolutionize the way people thought about life and the world. Also, given the super linear cost of large dies, it'd be far cheaper to produce as well. This is how AMD brought twice the performance at half the cost and beat Moore's Law manifold. Moore's Law is basically that with a microchip, the amount of transistors doubles every single year. And so it's gotten to the point where there are so many transistors, and Moore's Law has gotten to a point where it's just computing technology has gotten so complex that they've really just kind of appended Moore's Law. And a lot of people have said Moore's Law is dead. No, Moore's Law is not really dead. It's just moved on to complexity, and they call it systemic complexity. So instead of just being scaling up of transistors, they've gotten into all types of other crazy stuff here, like 3D tech and all this stuff, 2.5D and 3D integration techniques and stuff. So it's more than Moore's Law now. But anyway, I digress. So let me go back to this article. So of course, Intel's response to this was just FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And that's another crypto term. Whenever something new and amazing comes out, you're going to see a lot of FUD. And we see a bunch of Bitcoin FUD still to this day. Ethereum FUD on a day-to-day basis because of, Ethereum 2 rolling out and Ethereum gas prices. My God, the amount of FUD is just insane. So, and Intel just said, it's just glued together. Put together duct tape and Bondo. But it just so happens that a couple of years later, Intel comes out with their own version of it. You know, at the same time they're calling it, duct tape and Bondo, glued together in quotes, they're sitting there in the background being like, oh, crap, man, and they're making their own chip. So they're not going to call them chiplets because AMD did that. They'll call them tiles. So anyway, this is... they created a better one, but then of course then this creates the space race all again, so NVIDIA, AMD, Intel, and others, everyone is building high performance processors is going to transition to these modular processors or be technically obsolete or blockbustered. So note that mobile processors can get away with monolithic designs as they're tiny anyway, but low performance, but even mobile will make the pivot. So what does this have to do with blockchains? And I have to go here soon, but just like AMD split up the CPU to unlock impossible efficiency, blockchains are undergoing the same revolution. We're splitting up chains between execution, security, and data availability layers. So a monolithic blockchain scales to a few thousand or 10,000s of transactions per second TPS at most, despite crippling centralization and security compromises. A monolithic blockchain is trying to do all this execution, security, and data availability all on one chip. And it's like some big barge trying to, it's trying to like bring a huge 2x4 or a piece of plywood through a door while holding the plywood horizontal. And it's just not going to work, a modular, the bigger the wood piece of wood gets, right? So a modular architecture a modular architecture as opposed to that monolithic will scale to millions of TPS, transactions per second. And it makes me think of that movie Office Space, you know, Ron Livingston. He has like three different bosses. Have you turned in your TPS reports? Oh, I failed you. Did you get the memo? Did you turn in your TPS reports? Did you turn in your TPS reports? And so he was constantly talking about these TPS reports. And they never really said what it was, but he did work at a software company, and he was updating the Y2K switch. So that was his job. And so TPS is transactions per second, right? So, okay. Anyway, so this solves that. I digress, as usual. So a monolithic scales to a few thousand or maybe tens of thousands of TPS at most, despite crippling centralization and security compromises. So it goes faster, but it centralizes and its security is compromised. A modular architecture will scale to millions of TPS while still remaining highly secure and decentralized. It's orders of magnitude better on scalability, security, and decentralization. The trilemma. Like, for instance, people have been saying you can't have scalability, security, and decentralization all in one. You have to pick two, right? So scroll back up to the earliest AMD and Rome die. So the very, very first AMD die. So there's eight chiplets around one central chip. The central one is for data availability. And the eight chiplets are the roll-ups, right? Which is execution and security. So this is just the beginning, as Intel's Ponte Vecchio chip shows above, because Intel has 47 dies with a bunch of different chips and layers and tiles on them, and they all take care of different modular aspects, you know, such as the rollups would on a blockchain. So we'll see more efficient solutions like Volitions, where one execution layer settles on one security chain but spreads data availability across multiple layers. The skies are the limits. So the modular revolution is here for both processors and blockchains. Monolithic processors and monolithic blockchains are technologically obsolete at this point. And it's just crazy, because this roll-ups were not even a twinkle in daddy's eye in 2017. And here we are, 2021, and we're talking modular blockchains with roll-ups. You know, yeah, it's so sure. The monolithic blockchain incumbents will FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and lie through their teeth, just like Intel did, and duct tape and Bondo. But make no mistake, modular architecture are the only way blockchain industry will attain global scale. And that's as far as I'm going to go with that today. I can go a lot further, because there's a lot more that Polynya, P-O-L-Y-N-Y-A, on Medium blog is writing about all this stuff. And I've recently uncovered this treasure trove of stuff that Polynya has to offer. So yeah, if you get the chance, go take a look. I will link that in the video description. So yeah, you'll have access to all the stuff and can read a lot of the stuff and do your own research. And I don't mean that in a mean way. A lot of times whenever you get into a space, you get somebody, and you get some angry people sometimes in some spaces. They're like, D-Y-O-R. So the best way to counteract those people, whenever you come into a space and you just have people screaming at you and telling you you're making stupid questions and just a D-Y-O-R, then go in there with an assertion and act like you know it all. Then suddenly everybody will jump in and try to correct you, and you'll have all the information readily available at hand. And that's how social media works, ladies and gentlemen. You act like you know it all, and then suddenly everybody will correct you and they will have done the research for you. Yes. Oh, man. All right. Well, give me a thumbs up if you thought this content was, I guess, semi-entertaining. And tomorrow, who knows what I'll be talking about tomorrow. But I don't know. All right. Well, I will be. Thanksgiving's coming up. This is an interesting week. So I got to jump on my commute. It's 6:27 in the morning now. And I got to get on down to the grind. Contribute to that GDP. All right. I will talk to you tomorrow. Bye.